door-to-door salesman. I considered the idea that the guy was a real obit thief, casing the neighborhood, except that didn't work because he had been carrying his sample bag around the neighborhood before Mr. Bowditch died. I believed the magazine salesman was the man who had killed Mr. Heinrich. And by the way, just how had Heinrich been killed? The newspaper article didn't say. Wasn't it possible that the little man who said righto and ha-ha had tortured him before killing him? To get the name of the man with the stash of gold goodies? I turned from my right side to the left. My feet were sticking out and I fluffed the top sheet and the blanket back over them. Or maybe torture hadn't been necessary. Maybe Mr. Righto just told Heinrich that if he gave up the name, he wouldn't be killed. I went from my left side back to the right one, fluffed the blankets again. Radar raised her head, made a woofling sound, and went back to sleep. Another question. Had Detective Gleason spoken to Mrs. Richland? If he had, would he deduce that Mr. Bowditch had been targeted before he died? Or would he think the little guy was just casing the neighborhood for targets of opportunity? Maybe he'd think the little guy was just your ordinary garden variety door-to-door salesman. If he even bothered to ask at all, that was. Jackpot question. If Mr. Righto Ha Ha was still after the gold, would he be back? Right to left, left to right, fluff the blankets. At some point, I thought, the sooner I listen to Mr. Bowditch's tape, the better. And after that, I finally went to sleep. I dreamed that the little man with the skip in his walk was strangling me. And when I woke up the next morning, the sheet and blanket were all the way up around my neck. 5. I went to school on Friday just so Mrs. Silvius wouldn't forget what I looked like. But on Saturday, I told my dad I was going up to number one to start cleaning the place up. He offered to help. No, that's okay. Stay here with Radar. Kick back. Enjoy your day off. Are you sure? There have to be a lot of memories in that place for you. I'm sure. Okay, but call me if it starts to get you down or freak you out. I will. Shame he never told you the combination to that safe. We really will have to get somebody to crack it open so we can see what's inside. I'll ask around at work next week. Somebody will have a connection to a box peeler, one not in prison. Really? Insurance investigators have connections to all sorts of sketchy people, Charlie. Gleason's probably right, nothing but old tax returns, assuming Bowditch ever filled any out, which I doubt, and some cufflinks, but maybe there's stuff in there that can explain just who the hell he was. Well, I said, thinking of the gun and the tape recorder, you hold that thought, and don't give Radar too many treats. Bring her meds. Already did, I said. Kitchen counter. Good on you, kiddo. Call if you need me. I'll come running. Good guy, my dad, especially since he sobered up. Said it before, but it bears repeating. 6. There was yellow police investigation tape threaded in and out of the picket fence. The investigation, such as it was, had concluded when Gleason and the two unis left, but until Dad or I got someone to repair the lock on the back door, I thought I'd leave the tape up. I went around back, but before I went inside the house, I walked down to the shed and stood in front of the door. No sounds came from within. No scratching, no thuds, no weird mewlings. No, there wouldn't be, I thought. He killed whatever was making those noises. Two shots and boom, boom, out go the lights. I took out his key ring and thought about trying them until one fit the lock, then put the keys back in my pocket. First, I'd listen to the tape. And if it turned out to be nothing but Mr. Bowditch warbling Home on the Range or a bicycle built for two while high on OxyContin, the joke would be on me. Only I didn't believe that. Everything else you need is also under the bed, he told me, and the tape recorder had been under the bed. I opened the safe and took it out. Just an old black tape player, not as retro as the TV, but far from new. The technology had marched on. I went down to the kitchen, put the recorder on the table, and pushed play. Nothing. Just the hiss of tape passing across the heads. I started to think it was a bust after all, something like that safe of Al Capone's Gleason had mentioned. Then realized Mr. Bowditch just hadn't rewound it. Very possibly because he'd been recording when the heart attack hit. The idea creeped me out a little. "How that hurts," he'd said. "Like pig iron in the forge." I hit rewind. The tape spun backward for a long time. When it finally clicked to a stop, I pushed play again. There were a few seconds of silence, then a heavy clunk, followed by raspy breathing I knew very well. Mr. Bowditch began to speak. I said I was sure I could tell this story, but I was also sure no one would believe it. This is where your disbelief begins. 7.
"Did your father investigate me, Charlie?" "I bet he did. I know I would have if I'd been in his shoes. And I bet that given his job, he had the resources to do it. If so, he will have found out that someone named Adrian Bowditch, maybe my father, he would have thought, more likely my grandfather, bought this land the house stands on in 1920. It wasn't either of them. It was me. I was born Adrian Howard Bowditch in 1894, which makes me just about 120 years old. The house was finished in 1922, or maybe it was 1923. I can't remember for sure. And the shed, of course, we mustn't forget the shed. That was built even before the house and by my own hands. The Howard Bowditch, you know, is a fellow who likes to keep to himself and his dog, mustn't forget Radar, to himself. But Adrian Bowditch, my supposed father, was quite the rover. One Sycamore Street here in Century's Rest was his home base, but he was gone as much as he was here. I saw the changes in town every time I came back, like a series of snapshots. I found that fascinating, but also a bit disheartening. It seemed to me that so much in America was going in the wrong direction, and still does, but I suppose that's neither here nor there. I came back for the last time as Adrian Bowditch in 1969. In 1972, at the age of 78, I hired a caretaker named John McKean. Excellent older fellow, reliable. You'll find him in the town records if you choose to look. And went on my last trip, supposedly, to Egypt. But that is not where I went, Charlie. 3 years later, in 1975, I came back as my son, Howard Bowditch, age around 40. Howard supposedly lived most of his life up to then abroad with his mother, who was estranged from her husband. I always like that detail. Estrangement is somehow more real than divorce or death. Also, it's a wonderful word, full of flavor. After Adrian Bowditch supposedly died in Egypt, I took up residence at the family manse and decided to stay. There was no doubt about ownership. I had willed it to myself. Rich, wouldn't you say? Before I tell you the rest, I want you to stop the tape and go out to the shed. You can open it. You have my keys. At least I hope you do. There's nothing in there that can hurt you. The boards are back in place with the blocks on top of them. Christ, how heavy they were. But take my gun if you like. And take the flashlight, too, the one in the kitchen cupboard. There are lights in the shed, but you'll still want the flashlight. You'll know why. See what there is to see. The one you first heard will be mostly gone, maybe entirely, but the remains of the one I shot will still be there. Most of it, anyway. When you've had a shufti, as the Brits used to say, come back and listen to the rest. Do it now. Trust me, Charlie. I'm depending on you.
8. I pushed stop and for a moment just sat there. He was crazy. Had to be. Although he had never seemed crazy. He'd been lucid even at the end, when he called me and said he was having a heart attack. There was something in that shed, all right. Or had been. That much was undeniable. I'd heard it, radar had heard it, and Mr. Bowditch had gone out there and shot it. But 120 years old? Hardly anyone lived that long. Maybe 1 in 10 million, and nobody came back at 40 impersonating his own son? Stuff like that only happened in stories of make-believe. Fairy tales, I said, and I was so keyed up, so freaked out, that the sound of my own voice made me jump. Trust me, Charlie. I'm depending on you. I got up, feeling almost like I was outside myself. I don't know how to describe it any better than that. I went upstairs, opened the safe, and got Mr. Bowditch's .45. It was still in the holster, and the holster was still on the concho belt. I strapped it on and knotted the tie-downs above my knee. Doing that made the inside me feel absurd, like a little kid playing cowboy. The outside me was glad to have the weight of it, and knowing it was fully loaded. The flashlight was a good one, a long-barreled job holding 6 D-cells. I clicked it on once to make sure it worked, then went out and crossed the back lawn to the shed. Have to mow this again soon, I thought. My heart was beating hard and fast. It wasn't a particularly warm day, but I could feel sweat trickling down my cheeks and neck. I got the key ring out of my pocket and dropped it. I bent down to get it and bumped my head on the shed door. I grabbed the ring and picked through the keys. One of them had a round head with the word Studebaker engraved on it in script. The ones that opened the front and back doors of the house, I knew. Another was small, maybe for opening a lockbox, maybe even for a bank safety deposit box. And there was a Yale key for the big silver Yale padlock on the shed door. I stuck it in the base of the lock, then pounded on the door with my fist. Hey! I shouted, but a low shout. The last thing I wanted was for Mrs. Richland to hear. Hey! If you're in there, get back. I'm armed. There was nothing, but I still stood there with the flashlight in my hand, paralyzed with fear. Of what? The unknown. Which is the scariest thing there is.
Shit or get, Charlie,
I imagined Mr. Bowditch saying. I made myself turn the key. The arm of the lock popped up. I took it out, swung the hasp, and hung the lock over it. A breeze ruffled my hair. I opened the door. The hinges squalled. It was black inside. The light of the outside world seemed to enter and just fall dead. On the tape, he'd said there were lights, although there was certainly no power line going to the shed. I shone the flashlight on the right side of the door and saw a switch. I flipped it up, and 2 battery-powered lights went on, one mounted high up on each side. Like emergency lights for when the power goes out in a school or movie theater, they made a low humming sound. The floor was wooden planking. In the far left-hand corner, 3 boards were placed in a row with cinder blocks holding down the ends. I swung the flash to the right and saw something so horrible and unexpected that for a moment I couldn't comprehend it. I wanted to turn and run, but I couldn't move. Part of me was thinking, so far as any part of me could think in those first few seconds, that it was a macabre joke. A horror movie creature made out of latex and wire. I could see a single coin of light where a bullet had gone through the wall after going through the thing I was looking at. It was some kind of insect, but almost as big as a full-grown cat. It was dead, with its many legs sticking up. They were bent in the middle like knees and sprouted coarse hairs. A black eye peered sightlessly. One of Mr. Bowditch's bullets had caught it in the abdomen, and its pale, unknowable guts lay around its torn belly like weird pudding. A fine mist was drifting up from those innards, and as another gust of breeze slipped past me, still frozen in the doorway, my hand seemingly welded to the light switch, more mist began to rise from the thing's head and from spaces the armor plating on its back didn't cover. The staring eye fell in, leaving an empty socket that seemed to glare at me. I uttered a little cry, thinking it was coming back to life, but no. It was dead as dead could be. It was decomposing, and the fresh air was speeding the process. I made myself step inside with the flashlight in my left hand, trained on the carcass of the dead bug. The gun was in my right. I didn't even remember drawing it. When you've had a shifty, as the Brits used to say. I guess that meant when I had a look. I didn't like stepping away from the door, but I made myself do it. The outside me did it because it meant to have a shifty. The inside me was basically gibbering with terror, amazement, and disbelief. I moved toward the boards with the blocks on top of them. On the way, my foot struck something, and when I shone the light on it, I gave a cry of disgust. It was an insect leg, or what remained of one. I could tell by the hairs on it and the knee bend. I hadn't struck it hard, and I was wearing sneakers, but it broke in two. I thought it was part of the one I'd heard early on. It had died in here, and this was all that was left. "Hey, Charlie, have a leg," I imagined my father saying, handing me a fried chicken drumstick. "It's the best in the land." I started to gag and put the heel of my hand over my mouth until the urge to throw up passed. If the dead bug had stunk badly, I'm sure I wouldn't have been able to hold back, but it seemed to have little smell, maybe because the decomp had progressed beyond that point. The boards and cinder blocks were covering a hole in the floor, about 5 feet across. I first thought it was a well left over from the days before city water, but when I shone the light down between two of the boards, I saw short stone steps spiraling down the shaft. There were scuttering sounds and a low chittering deep in the dark. Half-glimpsed movement that froze me in place. More bugs, and not dead. They were retreating from my light, and suddenly I thought I knew what they were. Cockroaches. They were giant, economy-sized, but they were doing what cockroaches always did when you shone a light on them, running like hell. Mr. Bowditch had covered the hole, which led down to Christ only knew where, or what. But either he'd done a bad job, which wasn't like him, or the bugs had managed to shunt one or more of the boards aside over a long period of time. Like since 1920? My dad would have laughed, but my dad had never seen a dead roach the size of a tomcat. I took a knee and shone the light between the boards. If there were more big roaches, they were gone. There were just those steps, spiraling down and down. A thought came to me then, at first odd and then not odd at all. I was looking at Mr. Bowditch's version of Jack's Beanstalk. It went down instead of up, but there was gold at the other end. I was sure of it. 9. I backed out slowly, turned off the battery-powered lights, and shone my flash one last time on the horrid thing lying against the wall. More steam was rising from it now, and there was a smell, like sour peppermint. The fresh air was really doing a number on it. I closed the door, snapped the lock, and went back to the house. I returned the flashlight to the cupboard, and put the gun back in the safe. I looked at the bucket of gold pellets, but felt no urge to put my hands in it. Not today. What if I reached all the way to the bottom and felt a segment of hairy insect leg? I got as far as the stairs before my legs gave out, and I had to grab the newel post to keep from taking a nasty tumble. I sat down at the top, shaking all over. After a minute or two, I was able to get a grip on myself and go down, holding the banister in a way that reminded me of Mr. Bowditch. I sat down heavily at the kitchen table and looked at the tape player. Part of me wanted to eject the tape, yank it out in long brown ribbons, and dump it in the trash. But I didn't. Couldn't. Trust me, Charlie. I'm depending on you. I pushed play, and for a moment it was as if Mr. Bowditch was in the room with me, seeing how terrified I was, how astounded, and wanting to soothe me, to bring me back from thinking about how that huge insect's eye had fallen in, leaving the empty socket to glare at me. And it worked, at least a little. 10.
They're just cockroaches and not dangerous. A bright light puts them to flight. Unless you ran screaming at the sight of the one I shot, and that's not like the boy I've come to know, then you looked through the boards and saw the well and the steps going down. Sometimes a few of the roaches come up, but only when the weather starts to warm. I don't know why, because our air is lethal to them. They begin to decompose even when they're trapped below the boards, but they batter at them anyway. Some kind of instinctive death wish? Who can say? In the last couple of years, I've gotten careless about maintaining the barrier over the well. In the last few years, I've gotten careless about a lot of things. And so a couple got up. It's been long years since that happened. The one you heard in the spring died on its own. Nothing left now but a leg and one of its feelers. The other, well, you know. But they're not dangerous. They don't bite. I call it the Well of the Worlds, a name I got from an old pulp horror story by a man named Henry Kuttner. And I didn't really find it at all. I fell into it. I'll tell you as much as I can, Charlie. As Adrian Bowditch, I was born in Rhode Island, and although I was good at math and loved to read, as you know, I didn't care for school or my stepfather, who beat me when things went wrong in his life, which they often did, as he was a heavy drinker who couldn't hold a job for more than a few months at a go. I ran away when I was 17 and went north to Maine. I was a strapping lad and caught on with a logging crew way to hell and gone up in Aroostook County. That would have been 1911, the year Amundsen made it to the South Pole. Do you remember me telling you I was a simple woodcutter? It was the truth. 6 years I did that job. Then, in 1917, there come a soldier to our camp informing us that able-bodied men had to register for the draft at the Island Falls post office. Some of the younger lads piled into a truck, I among them, but I had no intention of feeding myself into the war machine somewhere in France. I reckoned that machine had enough blood to drink without adding mine. So I said so long to the boys as they lined up to register and hopped a freight headed west. I ended up in Janesville, not far from where we are now, and signed on with a cutting crew. When that played out, I followed the cutting down to Sentry County, which is now Arcadia County. Our county. There wasn't much cutting, and I thought of moving on, maybe out to Wyoming or Montana. My life would have been very different if I'd done that, Charlie. I would have lived a normal span and we never would have met. But in Buffington, where the forest preserve is now, I saw a sign that said, Land Surveyor Wanted. And below that, something that looked made for me. Must be wise in the ways of maps in the woods. I went into the county office, and after reading some maps, latitude, longitude, contours, and such, I got the job. Son, I felt like the man who fell into a pile of shit and came up with a rose in his teeth. I got to spend every fucking day tramping in the woods, blazing trees, and making maps and charting old woods roads, of which there were many. Some nights I stayed with a family willing to take me in, and some nights I camped under the stars. It was grand. There were times when I didn't see another living soul for days. That's not for everyone, but it was for me. There came a day in the fall of 1919 when I was on Sycamore Hill in what was known then as Sentry Woods. The town of Sentry's Rest was here, but it was really just a village, and Sycamore Street ended at the Little Rumple River. The bridge, the first bridge, wasn't built for another 15 years at least. The neighborhood you grew up in didn't come into existence until after World War II, when the GIs came home. I was walking in the woods where my backyard is now, pushing through the scrub timber and bushes, looking for a dirt road that was supposed to be somewhere up ahead, not thinking of a goddamn thing except wondering where in the village a young man might get a drink, and down I went. One moment I was walking in the sunshine, and the next I was in the well of the worlds. If you shone the flashlight between the boards, you know I was lucky not to be killed. There's no handrail, and the steps wind around a nasty drop, just about 175 feet. The walls are cut stone. Did you notice? Very old. God knows how old. Some of the blocks have fallen out and tumbled to the bottom, where there's a pile of them. As I tilted toward the drop, I threw my hand out and caught hold of a fissure in one of those empty sockets. Couldn't have been more than 3 inches wide, but it was enough to get my fingers into. I pulled myself back against the curve of the wall, looking up at daylight and bright blue sky, my heart beating what felt like 200 licks to the minute, wondering what the hell I'd stumbled into. It surely wasn't any ordinary well, not with stone steps going down and cut stone blocks walling it all around. When I got my breath back, there's nothing like almost falling to your death down a black hole to make you lose your breath. When I got it back, I pulled my electric torch off my belt and shone it down. I couldn't see a goddamn thing, but I heard rustling sounds, so something was alive down there. I wasn't worried. I also carried a holstered side piece on my belt in those days because the woods weren't always safe. It wasn't animals you had to worry about so much, although there were bears back then, plenty of them, as it was men, especially shiners. But I didn't think there was any moonshine still down that hole. I didn't know what there might be, but I was a curious lad, and I was determined to see. I fixed my pack, which had come all crooked when I fell on the steps, and went down, down and down, around and around. 175 feet deep is the well of the worlds, and 185 stone steps of varying heights. At the end is a stone-sided tunnel, or it might be better to call it a corridor. It's high enough so you could walk it without ducking your head, Charlie, and have most of your height again to spare. The floor was dirt at the foot of the steps, but after I went on a bit, I now know it measures out a little more than a quarter of a mile, it goes to stone flooring. That rustling sound kept getting louder and louder, like paper or leaves blowing in a light breeze. Soon it was overhead. I raised up my torch and saw the ceiling was covered with the biggest damn bats you ever saw. Wingspans like on a turkey buzzard. They rustled more in the light, and I lowered it back between my feet double quick, not wanting to send them flying all around me. The idea of being smothered by their wings gave me what my mother would have called the fantods. Snakes and most other insects are okay by me, but I've always had a horror of bats. Everyone has their own phobias, don't they? I went on and on, a mile at least, and my torch was starting to fail. No Duracells back in those days, boy. Sometimes there was a colony of bats overhead, and sometimes there wasn't. I made up my mind to go back before I was left in the dark, and just then I thought I saw a spark of daylight up ahead. I snapped off my torch, and sure enough, it was daylight. I went toward it, curious as to where I might come out. My guess was the north bank of the Little Rumpel, because it seemed to me I'd been heading south, although I couldn't be sure. I started for it, and just as I was nearing it, something happened to me. I can't describe it very well, but I need to try in case you decide to follow in my footsteps, so to speak. It was like being lightheaded, but it was more than that. I seemed to turn into a ghost, Charlie, like I could look down at my body and see right through it. I was insubstantial, and I remember thinking that we all are, really, just ghosts on the face of the earth trying to believe we have weight and a place in the world. It lasted maybe 5 seconds. I kept walking, even though I didn't really seem to be there. Then the feeling went away, and I went to the opening at the end of the tunnel, maybe another eighth of a mile, and came out, not on the bank of the Little Rumpel, but on the side of a hill. Below me was a field of gorgeous red flowers, poppies, I think, but with a smell like cinnamon. I thought, someone has rolled out the red carpet for me. A path led through them to a road where I could see a small house, a cottage really, with smoke coming from the chimney. Far away down the road, on the distant horizon, I could see the spires of a great city. The path was very faint, as if no one had walked it in a very long time. A rabbit hopped across it as I started down, twice the size of an earthly rabbit. It disappeared into the grass and flowers.
There was a pause here, but I could hear Mr. Bowditch breathing. It sounded raspier than ever, labored. Then he resumed.
This is a 90-minute tape, Charlie. I found a whole box of them amidst a rickrack on the third floor. From the days before, cassettes became as obsolete as 3-cent stamps. I could fill 4 of them, or 5, maybe even a whole box. I have had many adventures in that other world, and would tell them if I had time. I don't believe I do. Since my little bit of target practice in the shed, I haven't felt well at all. I'm having pain in the left side of my neck and down my left arm to the elbow. That sometimes fades a bit, but the heaviness in my chest doesn't. I know what such symptoms mean. There's a thunderstorm brewing inside me, and I think it will break soon. I have regrets, many of them. Once I told you that a brave man helps, but a coward only brings presents. Do you remember that? I brought presents, but only when I knew I wasn't brave enough to help when the terrible change came. I told myself I was too old, so I took gold and fled, like Jack scurrying down his beanstalk. Only he was just a boy. I should have known better. If you go to that other world, where 2 moons rise in the sky at night, and there's no constellation the astronomers of Earth have ever seen, you need to know certain things. So listen to me closely. The air of our world is fatal to the creatures of theirs, except, I guess, for the bats. I once brought back a rabbit as an experiment. It died quickly, but the air of theirs is not fatal to us. It is invigorating, in fact. The city was once a grand place, but now it's perilous, especially at night. If you enter, go only by day, and be very quiet once you pass through its gates. It may seem deserted, but but it isn't. What rules there is dangerous, terrible, and what lies beneath is more terrible still. I have marked the way to a plaza behind the palace, just as I used to mark the trees of the forest with my original initials, A.B. If you follow them, and if you are quiet, you'll be fine. If you don't, you may be lost in that terrible city until you die. I am speaking as one who knows. Without my blazes, I would be there still, dead or insane. What was once grand and beautiful is now gray and cursed and diseased.
There was another pause. The rasp in his breathing was louder now, and when he resumed, his voice was harsh, hardly like his own at all. I had an idea, almost a certainty, that while he was speaking these words, I was in school, either on my way to chem class or already there, determining the boiling point of acetone.
Radar has been there with me when she was young, hardly more than a puppy. She bounded down the steps of the well with no fear whatsoever. You know she goes on her belly when given the down command. She also knows to be quiet when given the hush or quiet command. I gave it to her that day, and we passed beneath the colonies of bats without disturbing them. She went through what I've come to think of as the border with no appreciable discomfort. She was delighted with the field of red flowers, bounding through them, rolling in them. And she loved the old woman who lives in the cottage. Most people of our world would turn in disgust from such as she is now, but I believe dogs sense the inner nature and ignore the outer aspect. Is that overly romantic? Perhaps, but it seems that way to... Stop. Mustn't ramble, no time. You may choose to take Radar with you, perhaps after you've had a shifty on your own, but perhaps right away, because time for her is growing short. With the new medicine, she may be able to negotiate those steps again. If she can, I'm sure the air of that place will enliven her, sure as I can be, at least. There were once games in the city, and thousands of people who came to watch congregated in the plaza I spoke of as they waited for entry to the stadium, which is part of the palace, or an adjunct to it, I suppose you'd say. Near this plaza is a huge sundial that must be 100 feet in diameter. It turns like the carousel in the novel, the Bradbury novel. I'm sure he... Never mind. Instead, mind this. The sundial is the secret of my longevity, and I paid a price. You must not get on it yourself, but if you were to put Radar on it... Oh, Christ. I think it's happening. My God.
I sat with my hands clenched on the kitchen table, watching the spinning reels. Through the player's window, I could see it was approaching the point I'd rewound it from.
Charlie, I hate to think of sending you into the source of so many of our earthly terrors, and I won't order you, but the sundial is there, and the gold is there, too. The blazes will lead you to it. A.B., remember that. I am willing you this house and the land, but it's not a gift, it's a burden. Every year it's worth more, and every year the taxes go up. Worse than the tax man, far worse. I live in fear of that legal horror known as eminent domain, and
He was panting for breath now, and swallowing again and again. Big, hard glugs that registered clearly on the tape. I could feel my fingernails cutting into my palms. When he spoke again, it was with terrible effort.
Listen, Charlie, can you imagine what would happen if people found out there is another world within reach, one that can be accessed simply by descending 185 stone steps and walking the length of a corridor not much more than a mile in length? If the government realized they had found a new world to exploit now that the resources on this one are nearly exhausted, would they fear the flight killer or waking the terrible god of that place from its long doze? Could they understand the terrible consequences of... But you... If you had the means, you...
There were rattles and clunks, gasps for breath. When he spoke again, his voice was still audible, but much fainter. He had put down the tape recorder with its little built-in mic.
I'm having a heart attack, Charlie. You know, I called you. There's a lawyer, Leon Braddock, in Elgin. There's a wallet under the bed. Everything else you need is also under the bed.
There was a final clunk, followed by silence. He'd either turned it off on purpose or struck the little stop button with a flailing hand. I was glad. I didn't need to listen to him suffer his final agonies. I closed my eyes and sat there for I don't know how long. Maybe a minute, maybe three. I remember reaching down once in my darkness, thinking I'd touch radar and find some of the comfort stroking her always brought me. But radar wasn't here. Radar was down the hill, in a sane house where there was a sane backyard and no hole in it. No crazy well of the worlds. What was I going to do? What in the name of God? To start with, I took the cassette tape out of the machine and put it in my pocket. It was dangerous. Maybe the most dangerous thing on Earth. But only if people believed it was something other than the ravings of an old man having a heart attack. They wouldn't believe, of course. Unless they... I got up on legs that felt undependable and went to the back door. I looked out at the shed Mr. Bowditch, a much younger Mr. Bowditch, had built over the Well of the Worlds. I looked at it for a long time. If someone went in there... Dear God. I went home.
Chapter 11. That night. School days. Dad leaves. The Well of the Worlds. The other. The old woman. A nasty surprise. 1. Are you all right, Charlie? I looked up from my book. I'd been deep into it. I would have said nothing could take my mind off the tape I'd listened to in Mr. Bowditch's kitchen, the one that was now hidden on the top shelf of my closet, under a stack of old T-shirts. But this one had. This one, which I'd taken from Mr. Bowditch's bedroom, had conjured its own world. Radar was sleeping beside me, occasionally giving out with little snores. Huh? I asked if you're all right. You hardly touched your dinner, and you've seemed off all evening. Thinking about Mr. Bowditch? Well, yeah. It was the truth, although not exactly the way Dad thought. You miss him? I do. A lot. I reached down and stroked Radar's neck. My dog now. My dog, my responsibility.
Well, that's okay. The way it should be. Are you going to be okay next week?
Sure, why? He gave the sort of patient sigh which I think maybe only dads can give.
The retreat. I told you about it. You had your mind on other things, I guess. I leave Tuesday morning for 4 wonderful days in the North Woods. It's an overland gig, but Lindy wangled me an invitation to come along. Plenty of seminars on liability, which will be merely okay, and some on vetting fraudulent claims, which is a big deal, especially for a firm just getting on its feet.
Like yours.
Like mine. Also bonding exercises. He rolled his eyes.
Will there be drinking?
There will, a lot, but not by me. Are you going to be okay on your own?
Sure.
Assuming I didn't get lost in what Mr. Bowditch claimed was a very dangerous city ruled over by a sleeping god. Assuming I went at all.
I'll be fine. If anything comes up, I'll call you.
You're smiling. Something funny?
Just that I'm not 10 anymore, Dad.
Actually, what made me smile was wondering if there was cell service in the well of the worlds. I was guessing Verizon hadn't opened that territory yet. Sure there's nothing I can help you with?
Tell him,
I thought.
Nope. All good.
What's a bonding exercise? I'll show you. Get up.
He got up himself.
Now stand behind me.
I put my book on the chair and stood behind him.
We're supposed to trust the team, Dad said. Not that I actually have one, being a one-man show, but I can be a good sport. We climb trees with a...
Trees? You climb trees?
On many overland retreats, sometimes not completely sober. With a spotter. We'll all do it, except for Willie Deegan, who has a pacemaker.
Jesus, Dad.
And we do this.
He fell backward with no warning, his hands loosely clasped at his waist. I wasn't playing sports anymore, but there was nothing wrong with my reflexes. I caught him easily, and looking at him upside down, I saw his eyes were closed and he was smiling. I loved him for that smile. I gave him a heave and he went back on his feet. Radar was looking at us. She made a
"roof"
sound and put her head back down.
I'll have to trust whoever's behind me. It'll probably be Norm Richards. But I trust you more, Charlie. We're bonded.
That's great, Dad, but don't fall out of any trees. Taking care of one guy who took a fall is my limit. Now, can I read my book?
Go for it.
He picked it up off the chair and looked at the cover.
One of Mr. Bowditch's?
Yes.
I read it when I was your age, maybe even younger. Crazy Carnival comes to a little town, right here in Illinois, as I remember.
Cougar and Dark's Pandemonium Shadow Show.
All I remember is that there was a blind fortune teller. She was creepy.
Yeah, the Dust Witch is mondo creepy, all right.
You read. I'll watch television and rot my brain. Just don't give yourself any nightmares.
If I sleep at all, I thought. 2. Although Radar could probably make it up the stairs with the new medicine on board, I went into the little guest room and she padded after me, already perfectly at home in our place. I undressed to my shorts, propped the extra pillow under my head, and kept reading. On the tape, Mr. Bowditch said there was a huge sundial in a plaza behind a palace, and it turned, like the carousel in the Bradbury novel, and it was the secret of his longevity. The sundial had allowed him to come back to Century's Rest, young enough to impersonate his own son. In Something Wicked, the carousel could make you older when it went forward, but younger when it was in reverse. And Mr. Bowditch had said something else, or started to. I'm sure he... Never mind. Had he started to say that Ray Bradbury had gotten his idea for the carousel from the sundial in that other world? The idea of gaining or losing years on a merry-go-round was crazy, but the idea that a respected American author had visited that other place was even crazier. Wasn't it? Bradbury had spent his early childhood in Waukegan, which was less than 70 miles from Century's Rest. A brief visit to Bradbury's Wikipedia entry convinced me that that was just a coincidence, unless he had visited the other world as a little kid, if there was another world. Anyway, by the time he was my age, he was living in Los Angeles. I'm sure he... Never mind. I marked my place in the book and put it on the floor. I was pretty sure Will and Jim would survive their adventures, but I guessed they would never be so innocent again. Kids shouldn't have to face terrible things. I knew that from experience. I got up and pulled on my pants. Come on, Raids. You need to go out and water the grass. She came willingly enough, not limping at all. She'd be lame again in the morning, but after a little exercise, her locomotion would smooth out. At least it had so far. That wouldn't last much longer if the vet's assistant had been right. She'd said she'd be surprised if Radar made it to Halloween, and that was only 5 weeks away. A little less, actually. Raid sniffed around on the lawn. I looked up at the stars, picking out Orion's belt and the Big Dipper, that old standby. According to Mr. Bowditch, there were 2 moons in that other world, and constellations the astronomers of Earth had never seen. Not possible. None of it. Yet the well was there. And the steps. And that horrible fucking bug. I had seen those things. Radar lowered her hindquarters in that delicate way of hers, then came to me looking for a treat. I gave her half a bones and led her back inside. I'd read late and my dad had gone to bed. It was time for me to do the same. Mr. Bowditch's dog, my dog, plopped down with a sigh and a fart, no more than a tweet, really. I turned off the light and stared up into the dark. Tell Dad everything. Take him out to the shed. The bug Mr. Bowditch shot will still be there, some of it, anyway. And even if it was gone, the well will be there. This is heavy, so share the load. Would my father keep the secret? Much as I loved him, I didn't trust that he would or could. There are 1,000 slogans and mottos in AA, and one of them is, "You're only as sick as your secrets." Might he confide to Lindy, or a trusted friend at work? His brother, my Uncle Bob? Then I remembered something from school, way back in 6th or 7th grade, American history, Miss Greenfield. It was a quote from Benjamin Franklin. 3 may keep a secret if 2 of them are dead. Can you imagine what would happen if people found out there is another world down there? That had been Mr. Bowditch's question, and I thought I knew the answer. It would be taken over. Co-opted, my hippy-dippy history teacher would have said. The house at 1 Sycamore Street would become a top-secret government installation. For all I knew, the whole neighborhood would be cleared. And yes, then the exploitation would begin. And if Mr. Bowditch was right, the consequences could be terrible. I finally went to sleep, but dreamed I was awake and something was moving under the bed. I knew, in the way of dreams, what it was. A giant roach. One that bit. I awoke in a small hour of the morning, convinced it was true. But Radar would have barked, and she was deeply asleep, woofling her way through some unknowable dream of her own. 3. On Sunday, I went up to Mr. Bowditch's house to do what I'd meant to do the day before, start cleaning the place up. There were some things I couldn't do, of course. The torn cushions and slashed wallpaper would have to wait. There was plenty of other stuff, but I had to take care of it in 2 separate shifts because the first time I brought Radar, and that was a mistake. She went from room to room downstairs, looking for Mr. Bowditch. She didn't seem to be upset by the vandalism, but barked furiously at the couch, only pausing to look at me every now and then, as if to ask if I was stupid. Couldn't I see what was wrong? Her master's bed had disappeared. I got her to follow me into the kitchen and told her to down, but she wouldn't, only kept looking toward the living room. I offered her a chicken chip, her favorite snack, but she dropped it on the linoleum. I decided I'd have to take her back home and leave her with Dad, but when she saw the leash, she ran, very limberly, through the living room and up the stairs. I found her in Mr. Bowditch's bedroom, curled up in front of the closet, on a makeshift bed of clothes that had been torn off their hangers. She seemed okay there, so I went back downstairs and made things as much better as I could. Around 11 o'clock, I heard the click of her nails on the stairs. Seeing her hurt my heart. She wasn't limping, but she moved slowly, with her head down and her tail drooping. She looked at me with an expression as clear as words. Where is he? Come on, girl, I said. Let's get you out of here. That time she didn't protest the leash.
4.
In the afternoon, I did what I could with the upstairs. The little man in the white sox cap and corduroy pants, assuming it was him, which I did, hadn't done any damage on the third floor, at least as I could see. I thought he'd concentrated his attention on the second floor, and on the safe, once he found it. He'd have been keeping an eye on the time, too, knowing that funeral services only last so long. I gathered up my clothes and put them in a little pile at the head of the stairs, meaning to take them home. Then I went to work on Mr. Bowditch's bedroom, righting the bed, which had been turned over, rehanging his clothes, tucking in pockets as I went, and picking up stuffing from the pillows. I was angry at Mr. Righto Ha-Ha for what seemed almost like a desecration of the dead, but I couldn't help thinking of some of the sorry crap I'd pulled with Birdie Bird. Dog shit on windshields, firecrackers in mailboxes, full garbage cans overturned, Jesus Jerks Off spray-painted on the signboard of Grace Methodist Church. We'd never been caught, and yet I had. Looking at the mess Mr. Ha-Ha had left behind and hating it, I realized I had caught myself. Back then, I'd been as bad as the little man with the funny way of walking and talking. Worse, in some ways. The little man at least had a motive. He'd been looking for gold. The Birdman and I had just been a couple of kids fucking off and fucking up. Except, of course, the Birdman and I had never killed anyone. If I was right, Mr. Ha-Ha had. One of the bedroom bookcases had been overturned. I set it upright and started reshelving the books. At the bottom of the pile was that scholarly-looking tome I'd seen on his nightstand, along with the Bradbury novel I was currently reading. I picked it up and looked at the cover. A funnel filling with stars. The origins of fantasy and its place in the world matrix. What a mouthful. And Jungian perspectives to boot. I looked in the index to see if there was anything about the story of Jack and the Beanstalk. Turned out there was. I tried to read it, then just scanned it. It was everything I hated about what I thought of as hoity-toity academic writing, full of $5 words and tortured syntax. Maybe that's intellectual laziness on my part, but maybe not. So far as I could make out, the author of that particular chapter was saying there were actually two Beanstalk stories, the bloodthirsty original and the sanitized version kids got in mom-approved Little Golden books and the feature-length cartoon. The bloodthirsty original bifurcated, there's one of your $5 words, into two mythic streams, one dark and one light. The dark one had to do with the joys of plunder and murder, as in Jack chopping down the beanstalk and the giant getting smushed. The light one had to do with what the writer called the epistemology of Wittgensteinian religious belief. And if you know what that one means, even with its headlights on, you're a better man than I am. I put the book on the shelf, left the room, then went back again to look at the cover. The inside was full of trudging prose, compound complex sentences that allowed the eye no rest. But the cover was a little lyric. As perfect, in its way, as that William Carlos Williams poem about the red wheelbarrow. A funnel filling with stars. 5. On Monday, I went to see my old pal Mrs. Silvius in the office and asked her if I could take my once-a-semester community service day on Tuesday. She leaned over the desk toward me and spoke in a low, confidential voice.
"Do I smell a boy who wants to play hooky?" I only ask because students are asked to give at least 1 week's notice before they take their in-service day. Not a requirement, Charlie, but a strong suggestion.
"No, this is the real deal," I said, making earnest eye contact. It was a useful technique when telling lies that I had learned from Birdie Bird. "I'm going around to downtown merchants and pitching them on Adopta."
"Adopta?"
Mrs. Silvius looked interested in spite of herself. "Well, it's actually Adopta Highway. I got into that with Key Club, but I want to go farther. Get store owners interested in Adopta Park. We've actually got 6 of them, you know. And Adopt an Underpass? So many of them are messes, it's really a shame. Maybe even adopt a vacant lot if I can convince...
I get the drift.
She grabbed a form and scribbled on it.
Take this around to your teachers, get a sign-off from all of them, and bring it back to me.
And as I left...
Charlie, I still smell hooky. I smell it all over you.
I wasn't exactly lying about my community service project, but I was shading the truth about needing a day off from school to do it. During period 5, I went to the library, got a JC's booklet listing all the downtown merchants, and sent out an e-blast, just changing the salutations and the names of the various Adopta projects I'd thought up. It took half an hour, which left me with 20 minutes before the chime announcing the change of classes. I went back to the desk and asked Ms. Norman if she had Grimm's Fairy Tales. The actual book wasn't in the library, so she handed me a Kindle with Property of Hillview High Dymo tape to the back and gave me the one-use-only code to download the book. I didn't read any of the fairy tales, only ran down the contents and skimmed the introduction. I was interested, but not entirely surprised, to find that most of the ones I knew from childhood had darker versions. The original of Goldilocks and the Three Bears was an oral tale that had been around since the 1500s, and there was no little girl named Goldilocks in it. The main character was a vile old woman who invaded the bears' home, basically broke all their shit, then jumped out a window and ran away into the woods, cackling. Rumpelstiltskin was even worse. In the version I vaguely remembered, old Rumpel flew away in a huff when the girl tasked with spinning straw into gold guessed his name. In the 1857 version of Grimm's, he drove one foot into the ground, grasped the other, and tore himself apart. I thought that was a horror story worthy of the Saw franchise. Period 6 was a single semester course called America Today. I had no idea what Mr. Masensik was saying. I was thinking about make-believe, how the carousel in Something Wicked was like the sundial in the Land of Other, for instance. The secret of my longevity, Mr. Bowditch had said. Jack had stolen gold from the giant. Mr. Bowditch had also stolen gold from who or what? A giant? Some Pulp Fiction demon named Gogmagog? Once my mind started down this path, I saw similarities everywhere. My mother had died on a bridge spanning the Little Rumpel River. And what about the little man with the funny voice? Wasn't that how the story described Rumpelstiltskin? And then there was me. How many stories of make-believe featured a young hero, like Jack, on a quest in a fantastic land? Or take The Wizard of Oz, where a tornado lifted a little girl out of Kansas and into a world of witches and munchkins. I wasn't Dorothy, and Radar wasn't Toto, but... Charles? Have you fallen asleep back there? Or perhaps my mellifluous voice has hypnotized you, entranced you? Laughter from the class, most of whom wouldn't have known mellifluous from a piss hole in the snow. No, I'm right here. Then perhaps you'd give us your considered opinion concerning the blue-on-black shootings of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling? Bad shit, I said. I was still mostly in my own head, and it just popped out of my mouth. Mr. Masensik favored me with his trademark thin smile, then said, "Bad shit indeed. Please feel free to re-enter your trance state, Mr. Reed." He continued his lecture. I tried to pay attention, but then I thought of something Mrs. Silvius had said. Not, "Fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman," but, "I still smell hooky. I smell it all over you." Surely a coincidence. My father said if you bought a blue car, you saw blue cars everywhere. But after what I'd seen in the shed, I couldn't help wondering. And something else. In a fantasy story, the author would invent some way that the young hero or heroine could explore that world I was starting to think of as the other. The author might, for instance, invent a retreat his parent or parents had to attend for several days, thus clearing the way for the young hero to visit the other world without provoking a bunch of questions he couldn't answer. Coincidence, I thought, as the class-ending chime went and kids bolted for the door. Blue car syndrome. Except the giant roach was no blue car, and neither were those stone steps winding down into the dark. I got Mr. Masensik to sign my community service slip, and he gave me his thin smile.
Bad shit, eh?
Sorry.
Actually, you weren't wrong.
I made my escape and headed for my locker.
Charlie?
It was Arnetta Freeman, looking relatively gorgeous in her skinny jeans and shell top. With blue eyes and blonde hair down to her shoulders, Arnetta proved that white America ain't all bad. The year before, when I'd been more sporty and at least a little bit famous for my turkey bowl heroics, Arnetta and I had spent several study sessions in her basement family room. Some studying had been done, but a lot more making out.
Hey, Arnie, what's up? Do you want to come over tonight? We could study for the Hamlet test.
Those blue eyes looking deep into my brown ones.
I'd love to, but my dad's leaving for most of the rest of the week tomorrow. Some kind of business thing. I better stick around.
Oh, pooh, that's a shame. She hugged two books tenderly to her breasts.
I could Wednesday night, if you're not busy, that is.
She brightened.
That'd be fantastic.
She took my hand and placed it on her waist.
I'll quiz you on Polonius, and maybe you can check out my Fortinbras.
She gave me a peck on the cheek, then walked away, backside switching in a way that was, well, bewitching. For the first time since the library, I wasn't thinking about real-world parallels to make-believe ones. My mind was on nothing but Arnetta Freeman.
6.
My dad left bright and early on Tuesday morning, carrying his traveling bag and wearing his I'm going to the woods clothes, corduroy pants, flannel shirt, bear's hat. He carried a poncho slung over one shoulder.
Rain in the forecast, he said. That'll put the kibosh on any tree climbing, for which I'm not sorry.
Club soda at cocktail hour, right?
He grinned.
Maybe with a slice of lime.
Not to worry, kiddo.
Lindy will be there, and I'll stick with him. Take care of your dog. She's limping again.
I know. He gave me a quick one-armed squeeze and a kiss on the jaw. As he backed down the driveway, I held up my hand in a stop gesture and ran to the driver's side window. He lowered it.
Did I forget something?
No. I did. I leaned in, hugged him around the neck, and kissed his cheek. He gave me a puzzled smile.
What was that for?
I just love you, that's all.
Same here, Charlie.
He patted my cheek, backed into the street, and took off toward the goddamn bridge. I watched him go until he was out of sight. I guess that down deep, I knew something.
7.
I took radar out back. Our yard wasn't much compared to Mr. Bowditch's acre plus, but it was big enough to give Raid some room to limber up. Which she eventually did, but I knew her time was getting short. If there was something I could do for her, it would have to be soon. We went back in, and I gave her a few spoonfuls of the leftover meatloaf from last night, hiding an extra pill in it. She wolfed it down, then curled up on the living room rug, a place that she'd already staked out as her own. I rubbed her behind her ears, which always made her close her eyes and grin.
I have to check something out, I said. Be a good girl. I'll be back as soon as I can, okay?
Try not to shit in the house, but if you have to, do it someplace where it'll be easy to clean up. She flapped her tail on the rug a couple of times. That was good enough for me. I rode my bike up to number one, keeping my eye out for a funny little man with a funny way of walking and talking. I saw no one, not even Mrs. Richland. I let myself in, went upstairs, opened the safe, and buckled the gun belt around my waist. I didn't feel like a gunslinger, in spite of the fancy conchos and the tie-downs. I felt like a scared kid. If I slipped on those spiral stairs and fell, how long would it be before someone found me? Maybe never. And if they did, what else would they find?
On the tape, Mr. Bowditch had said what he was leaving me wasn't a gift, but a burden. I didn't fully understand that then, but as I took the flashlight from the kitchen cupboard and shoved the long barrel into the back pocket of my jeans, I sure did. I went out to the shed, hoping that I'd get to the bottom of those steps and find not a corridor leading to some other world, but only a pile of blocks and a scummy pool of groundwater. And no big cockroaches. I don't care if they're harmless or not. No roaches. I went into the shed, shone the light around, and saw that the roach Mr. Bowditch had shot was subsiding into a dark gray puddle of goo. As I put the flashlight beam on it, one of the plates on what remained of its back slid off, making me jump. I turned on the battery lights, went to the boards and blocks covering the well, and shone my light through one of the 6-inch cracks. I saw nothing but the steps, winding down into darkness. Nothing moved. There were no scuttering sounds. This did not soothe me. I thought of a line from a dozen cheap horror movies, maybe 100. I don't like it. It's too quiet. Be sensible. Quiet is good, I told myself. But looking into that stone pit, the idea didn't have much force. I understood that if I hesitated for long, I'd back out, making it twice as hard to get even this far again. So, I stuck the flashlight in my back pocket once more and lifted away the cement blocks. I slid the boards aside. Then I sat down on the lip of the well, my feet on the third step. I waited for my heart to slow down, a little, then stood on that step, telling myself there was plenty of room for my feet. This wasn't precisely true. I armed sweat from my forehead and told myself everything was going to be all right. This I didn't precisely believe. But I started down.